And we were just in PE and playing soccer. And this one boy who was cute, I kicked it and he went, "Ooh, that was good, Lise," and sort of packed Lise and yeah. pat me on the back. And I went, "Oh my God, is it possible
you're
he could like me?
The team. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. Could he like me? Could I have a boyfriend?" Like you just like go to yeah. and then, "Oh my God, it's what high school is he going to? Will we be at the same high school? Can exactly. we get married?" Yeah, yeah. I'm just like,
Lisa, that's what I'm like today. I'm like still in that. Like, wait, he waved at me with like a smile? What does it mean?
What were our children yeah. look like?
Exactly.
This is Pod Crushed,
the podcast that takes the sting out of rejection, one crushing middle school story at a time.
And where guests share their teenage memories, both meaningful and mortifying.
And we're your hosts. I'm Nava, a former middle school director.
I'm Sophie, a former fifth grade teacher.
And I'm Penn, a middle school dropout. We're just three Baha'is who are living in Brooklyn.
Wanting to make stuff together
with a particular fondness for awkward nostalgia.
Well, I struggle with nostalgia. I'm here for the therapy.
So, Penn, I am aware that you are directing an episode of You this season, and you're, like, right in the thick of it. How's that going?
It's just, it's a lot of preparation and organization, which, Nava, you know, is where I excel.
What you love. That's where you shine.
Yeah. Well, I've managed to have a career where, you know, being organized is not really a part of any of that. And it's like, I'm looking forward to being on set, even though I know that like once the clock starts, it's just, you know, in television, you are just the entire time. You're basically like, all right, how under the gun am I? It's pretty intense.
I have a probably really ridiculous question, but I was in the car with David the other day and I just like stopped us in our tracks. And I was like, how does Penn direct when he's in the scene? Like, are you thinking kind of simultaneously about your own character, but also what notes you might give to other characters in the scene? Like, just logistically, how does that work?
Do you cut yourself off?
Well, the truth is I'm already watching. Like, Joe is such a harshly, harshly critical mind. He's basically watching the person I'm in a scene with. Mm-hmm. So I already basically watch them silently while I'm in a scene with them.
That's so interesting.
The one thing that is tough is that I'm in every scene nearly, like literally nearly. And that is hard to direct at the same time. So how that's going to function, I'll have stories next episode, I guess.
Nice.
And that's that story. That's Nava, how's your puppy?
Well, my puppy's doing great, but I was going to share this week. I'm going to have like a Larry David gripey moment. I've had like a medical issue that I've been struggling with for about a year, and it's not like threatening, but it is very annoying. And I've seen like three different doctors here in LA, and none of them were like, "Hey, you should go see a specialist for this kind of, you know, issue." None of the diagnoses were accurate, and none of the treatment plans were working because it was inaccurate. And I've been like struggling with this. And I finally went and saw a specialist because I myself like researched it and was like, "Oh, this is the kind of doctor I should be seeing." So I went and saw a specialist in the OC. He like did a test, diagnosed me accurately, put me on a treatment. It's already working. And I was just feeling so upset that like for a year I've been dealing with something that like if one of the doctors had just been like, "Hey, this isn't my specialty. Let me refer you to a specialist."
So Nava, like, the key with Larry David is that he's funny.
And Penn's comeback moment.
The thing that happened there, see,
is that it was just a rant.
That is hilarious.
Note taken.
Today's guest is none other than, well, the truly, factually, rarely can you say this the way I can right now, but the iconic Lisa Kudrow. Yes, the Lisa Kudrow, the Emmy Award winning, SAG Award winning, Golden Globe nominated actor who won over the public as Phoebe Buffay on a show called Buddies. On Friends. She's been in, I mean, just like so many movies, too many to list. One of them actually is something I almost forgot that we were in together, Easy A. So today's conversation was almost like a reunion, except one of the people present didn't know the other one. And I won't tell you which one that was. You're not going to want to miss this. Stick around.
When Penn is ready, we'll just get started.
I think I'm ready. I think I am.
Penn, are you going to welcome Lisa?
you know, this is what I'm so bad at this. I'm so used to doing interviews.
Oh, yeah.
Lisa, honestly, this is...
What on earth are you doing here?
that's a good question. Honestly, yeah, I share with my co-hosts the... it's really an honor to have you with us. So thank you for coming on.
Thanks for asking me to be on.
So we wanted to ask you sort of as a kickoff question, is there a memory that you associate with your own coming of age?
Coming of age. Mm. So in junior high, this is obviously before social media, it was still 1977. And girls would do this thing where you sit around in a circle and it's called like a bull session.
Okay.
Or a bullshit session. Also, you have to know that this is taking place in Encino, California, which is... the valley.
Oh, yeah.
And sit in a circle and go around each person to everyone in the circle and say, okay, Karen, like, I love you, but you do this thing that is so annoying. And I hate it when you say, hi, how are you doing? It's so phony. I just think you're so phony.
Wow.
And like the few times that I was even allowed into a circle, no one would have anything to say about me. It was, okay, Lisa, like, I don't really know you. So,
was that worse than being like, I hate this about you?
So invisible, yeah. Irrelevant, completely non-existent. And I would try to reframe it because I'm good at that. You know, like, okay, so nothing bad.
I mean, that was my first thought. I was like, oh, you got out scot-free, but.
No, I didn't exist. They were engaged with each other and I didn't exist. And that's like the best of my stories.
Wow.
From junior
how did
high.
You even get invited into this bullshit circle session, would you call it?
Yeah, bull session or bullshit session. It would happen at slumber parties if I was I found a way to get myself invited to it. Yeah, one time it was something in gym, and for whatever reason, we had to wait, and we weren't doing anything, and, you know, hey, we're not doing anything. Let's tear each other apart.
Wow.
That's really bold. I think the equivalent for me in my middle school years, we definitely did that kind of thing, but it was all anonymous. It was online. It was...
Oh, that's horrible.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out which one's worse.
Oh, it's all
which
horrible.
Which one's worse, to have it in your face, know who said it?
And after me, but before... online stuff, there were these notebooks that got passed around where people would write things about someone, and it just got passed around.
It's really vicious.
All that to say, whatever's happening online, it's been happening.
Lisa, maybe you can paint a broader picture for us of like who you were in middle school, 12, 13. What were you interested in? Who were your friends?
So elementary school, I was popular. I had a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. Around halfway through sixth grade, it just started happening where it becomes about boys and how attractive you are and social positioning. And I remember a girl once saying to me, it's so weird that, you know, you were popular and now you're not.
Wow.
And I went, what? I don't even know what you're talking about. I've always sort of been like a little bit elsewhere, you know? And I didn't understand that and I didn't care. And then seventh grade, my best friends at the time, you know, had gone to Hebrew school. So they knew people already. And, you know, that's not a time of, oh, allow me to introduce you to Lisa. You know, that didn't happen. So I'd be, wouldn't know what to say because they're talking about Hebrew school. I can't really participate and no one's saying anything. No one's introducing me. And at one point in seventh grade, my best friends sent me a note like, hi, we're in Hebarf and we're really bored. And, you know, we just want to say that, you know, we're talking in a group and you just sort of stand there and you don't say anything, you don't do anything. And I think it would be really good for you if you were just on your own now.
Oh my gosh. I thought they were going to invite you in.
Yeah,
that went
me too.
Totally different than what I was picturing.
Completely dropped. I had one friend, thank God for her. And on short days, you know, half days, everyone would like make plans, go to lunch, out. And my sister, who's 8 years older than me, this might make me cry. Mm. So if I'm like 13, she's 21. She would find out when my short days were and come pick me up and take me to lunch. Because I had no friends to go with.
That's very touching.
Yeah.
That was really sweet. Yeah.
Lisa, you were saying that like those friends had said to you, you were standing in the circle, you weren't saying much. And I'm wondering, why was that? Was it because you just weren't interested? Were you shy?
I didn't know how to participate. They were talking about like Hebrew school and And they were trying to sound stupid, and I didn't understand that either, you know? I mean, so I really didn't fit in. I loved vocabulary tests, and
same,
you know, I would make a point of, you know, using those words in a sentence if I could. And part of their letter, one of their grievances was, and you use these words, like, that nobody knows, and who cares, and you're, you know. I just thought it was really important to sound smart, whether you were or not. And I mean, I would say things like, oh, that sounds like an iatrogenic problem, you know, that
don't know what that
caused
means.
By, you know, medical treatment that went wrong. I was quoting Macbeth, like, oh, wow, it's like the three witches, up is down and down is up, and, you know, fair is foul and foul is fair. And and that's how it felt to me. It just felt like, wow, but the popular people aren't nice. It's not like they have a lot of friends because they're so nice. They have a lot of friends because everyone's afraid of them. It just did not make sense to me. And everybody else, it felt like they were just getting with the program. You know, there's a social hierarchy, and I've got to figure out how to navigate it.
Yeah, you stood outside of it.
Did these feelings of isolation, maybe isolation is a strong word, but I'll go ahead and use it. Like, did the feeling of isolation contribute to your desire to perform, or the way that, because I know that it's probably true with a lot of actors and artists. I know it was for me. I mean, it was performing was the only place that I had ever felt this sort of community, you know, like people uniting around a common goal. And then, and also what I loved was just that it was a lot of different kinds of people, different ages. And, you know, it seemed like a more diverse background than, I don't know, going to school, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I did do this thing called, it was like a play production or something. And yeah, I was funny. You'd do lip syncs and you'd make up sketches and you'd do stuff. And then the school, different classes would come in and watch and you'd perform. And it was something that I was good at. And so there was a certain level of respect finally. Mm. And then other friends, you know, that I could sort of make there. And I did. I invited them all to my bat mitzvah. And they, you know, and they were all like, oh, thanks. Didn't know we knew each other that well to be invited, but I didn't care. I was like, yeah, no, it's, I mean, yeah, come. I don't care. You're my new friends. Only.
Tell us about your first crush or your biggest crush or your biggest heartbreak around that.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, this is that stuff I was talking about isn't the bad stuff, by the way. Mm. So I did have a huge crush on this boy who was so adorable. And we were in the same math class and he seemed really nice, but, you know, we didn't really speak. Okay, so here's the bad thing. So one day I was late to my math class and I went to my locker, and my locker was next to a guy who was in ninth grade. I'm in seventh grade. And he's there and he's good friends with a really popular guy. And he starts making fun of me, and then he shoves me up against the locker and starts pumping.
Whoa.
Oh,
and
goodness.
I don't know what was going on. And I, you know, was crying. And I could see out of the corner of my eye, the popular guy looked really uncomfortable. I was like, okay, man. And then the guy stopped and I picked up all my stuff and I'm crying and I turn around. And the boy that was so nice that I had a crush on was far away coming across the quad. He was late to our math class. And he was also kind of small. He's in seventh grade. So he was just trying to look away and look down. And just on every level, all of it was just, well, obviously, really humiliating. Aww. And then when I told my one friend that I had about it, she said, oh, my God, like the popular guy, he's good friends with my brother. He's a totally cool guy. You make such a big deal out of everything.
Whoa.
So I just clammed up and I didn't talk about it because I make a big deal out of everything, I guess, you know. It was such an upside down period to me. I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm. It's also just so shameless that he did it so public. Like, it just also, speaks to the culture, the fact that that's like allowed because he did it in front of people and there were no consequences. It's just awful.
I mean, look, I think being a kid anyway, especially then, you're not fully human in the eyes of adults, right? And then when you're a seventh grader with a ninth grader, you definitely aren't entitled to the regular respect, you know, that others get. And and then if you're an ugly girl, then you don't count at all, is sort of how it felt to me. God,
Did you ever tell any adults about that? Or did you kind of, after your friend said it didn't matter, did you have to just kind of move on and not talk about it anymore?
I think I did tell my parents, but I wouldn't have been able to describe it the way I could describe it now, because I didn't know. He pushed me up against the locker was maybe all I could say, you right. know? And my father just said, asshole. He's an asshole. What's his name? You know. Okay. And I had an older brother too. And they're like, oh God, so stupid. And my father would say, boys, young, they're the most dangerous, you know, men. They have no judgment. And then he did actually, what was great about my dad, he was saying, you have to understand something about the adolescent brain. If you look at an EEG, here's where I got that like nerd thing from. Mm-hmm. He's like, if you look at an EEG of their brains, it's total chaos. There's no organization at all. Mm. So that's who you're dealing with. You know? I was like, okay, yeah.
So it sounds a bit like you had a challenging time in middle school and maybe some social isolation, but from what you're sharing, it sounds like you had a sweet family life. Is that accurate? Yes. Can you share a little bit about your family dynamics?
My family was great. Yeah, I told you. My sister was so great. My brother was great. And my parents also were as supportive as they could be, you know, because it wasn't the kind of thing where you, you know, they'd like call the school and have something done or, you know, that wasn't about to happen at all. And you don't want it to happen because
then what?
Oh, shoot. Yeah. Then it's really bad.
Further isolation.
But I have to say, the play production and getting to be funny, and that saved me. I mean, and it protected me in a way because then there was some value to me. Hmm. And I think that's around when I could be invited into a Bull session, even though no one knew me very well.
Do people have a perception of you as funny? Was that happening?
That was starting to happen.
Is anyone else in your family funny?
Yes. My family was, my father is hilarious. And so my sister and my brother, my mom didn't really make jokes. And she really only laughed if someone fell down or got hurt. which we all laughed about, you know. But my family was really funny. My dad was very funny.
That just reminded me, when I was a kid, I remember one of my mom's favorite things, this is going to make her sound really bad, but was to watch figure skating just to see people fall down.
I can't handle that. It makes me so nervous. I'm like, anytime they mess up, I'm just like, I can't do it. I don't like watching.
Yeah, I loved watching figure skating too.
Lisa, were you athletic at all?
I was really athletic. I was like softball. I felt like, oh, I can hit a home run every time, and every sport I wanted to be really good at. I didn't like football ever. And I didn't like dodgeball. I don't like balls being thrown at my face.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And then that thing where, you know, and then soccer, and it was sort of co-ed by ninth grade. And I don't know why or how. And we were just in PE and playing soccer. And this one boy who was cute, I kicked it and he went, ooh, that was good, Lise. And sort of packed Lise and pat me on the back. And I went, oh my God, is it possible
you're
you could like
of
me?
The team. Yeah. Cute. Yes. That's so cute.
It's honestly the smallest things at that age.
Right.
Like someone calling you Lise. Yeah.
Yeah. Could he like me? Could I have a boyfriend? Like you just like go to and then, oh my God, it's what high school is he going to? Will we be at the same high school? Can we get married? Yeah. I'm just like,
Lisa, that's what I'm like today. I'm like still in that like, wait, he waved at me with like a smile? What does it mean?
What were our children look like?
Exactly.
So it sounds like you actually had some confidence, and it was just maybe this, I mean, I don't know, because it sounds again like you had some support at home, and it sounds like, you know, you responded so readily, like, yeah, I was athletic. Not everybody does that. So so it sounds like you kind of had some, I don't know, a good foundation, and it was just this period.
Yeah. No, I was confident. And by the way, I half think that if you are confident, but there's a weakness, that's when the mob goes for you. It's such a hideous time for everybody. And then if there's someone who seems to like themselves, there's that, why do you get to like yourself?
Right.
I hate myself. You know, I've got all these things and I'm barely holding on to my, you know, station in our group, you know? And then they just try to like go after.
That also sounds like what happens to women in Hollywood. Like women in Hollywood who are very confident, I feel like it's like, time to tear her down.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's just about exposure. It's like, oh, so you must be feeling pretty confident because everybody knows who you are. So what can we find? Also that's a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, more good stuff isn't a story.
I've read a couple of things you've said in interviews about feeling maybe some body dysmorphia, maybe just like body image issues, especially on Friends. And I think in particular that time period was really rough for women in terms of body image. Like the image of beauty was like stick thin. But I'm wondering if that started for you there or if you had those feelings when you were younger too.
No, I did not.
Oh, really?
I had body dysmorphia in the way of, oh, I'm a stick, just like my sister, just like my dad. And I wasn't at all. I didn't see it. I had no waist. I didn't see it at all. Mm-hmm. I thought I was just really skinny and I can just do whatever. No, especially in high school. And I'd look at pictures and say, wow, pictures really distort reality. Mm. And it wasn't until Friends that I realized, oh, I don't look like I thought I looked. Mm-hmm. And that's what was so jarring. And that's when it was like, oh, I've got to actually lose weight. I have to diet. Shoot.
And did you feel that way? Was it internal or was it headlines that made you feel that way? What was it?
It wasn't headlines. It was just seeing myself on the show and seeing myself in clothes and seeing Courtney and Jennifer in clothes. And at first I thought, oh, because they know like tailoring, so they can discuss it with the, you know, costume designer about where exactly to take something in, you know. And then I'd ask one of them, like, can you come with me to my fitting? And they would, because honestly, they were, it's like sisters, you know. They were so, oh, and they'd come in like, yeah, no, you got to take it in here. You got to take it in there. And yeah, honey, do that. Let's do that. And then that's when I would see, oh, okay. It's not just about tailoring. Mm. You know, I'm not trying to say I was overweight either. Mm-hmm. I was not, but I just had no idea the shape of, you know, my actual body.
Did you end up having to do any work to undo that, or did that perception of your body just continue?
At some point, maybe not till like my late 30s or 40s, I don't know. I just realized, oh, no, it's okay. This is just what I look like. That's okay. Yeah. That's okay. I mean, do what you need to do to be healthy, but this is your body. It's okay. But I think it also happened around a time when I felt like, remember, you only wanted to be a character actress. You're not going for, you know, romantic comedies, romantic lead. You don't do that. And that's not like a fun role for you anyway. So knock it off. Mm. It's okay. You can look fine as you are. And my husband, too, has always loved me the way I was, but wanted me to be healthy, you know.
Right.
I feel like you're very beautiful, but you don't need to hear that from a random person. But just to say that I've always felt you were really beautiful. So just wanted to say that. Yeah.
Just makes me think that, like, my experience of coming up in Hollywood, you know, it feels to me like no matter how close to the top or at the top anyone gets, you always feel and get a sense of what's lacking. You always feel as though you need to be one person closer to the top of the pyramid. You're always feeling, I feel like a certain inadequacy is highlighted because the kind of extreme standard you're comparing yourself to is literally, it includes the likes of, you know.
Yeah, yeah, Tom Cruise. Yeah, but that's the other thing I had to realize. That's all in your own head. You're doing that to yourself. That's no one needs you to be Tom Cruise.
Yes.
Or as famous as Tom Cruise, or, you know, for me at that time, you know, Julia Roberts, Meg Ryan, no one's actually requiring that of me. I mean, representatives, your agents, people, you know, I'm sure they'd love for you to be, you know, at the top of the pyramid, but that's it. I mean, we know we can't pay attention to that. Mm. So it's just, that's something that we're bringing to the table.
Well, I feel like that's kind of amazing that you didn't have those kind of insecurities when you were younger. I feel like if you could get through that age and not be so consumed with your body and insecurities, then that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, as much as that time and how, you know, sad I just, you know, made it sound, and it was hard, there was part of my brain that was, this is wrong. It's upside down. Mm. It won't be like this in adulthood. This is crazy times and it can't count too much. it's impossible to go to school every day with this. I don't know. Like, how do I get through that, though? My peers are crazy people, you know? This is my society, my community. My society is all insane people whose brains don't work. I can't.
It's amazing you had that perspective.
It really is.
I did. Yeah. But I had it side by side with, what do I do tomorrow? Because it hurts. Yeah. You know, it still hurts. So what do I do?
It also sounds like you were really ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. This is just a random thing, but there, you know, I don't know if you heard of that show Dawson's Creek. It like premiered in the 90s, but it was written in a way where the character spoke like extremely ornately and like very sophisticated vocabulary. And I was in high school when that happened, and there was like a shift in how like it was perceived to like speak that way.
Wait, Dawson's Creek, people, the characters spoke eloquently?
Very eloquently. It was like a thing that was written about quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah. It was like you could like improve your SAT vocabulary if you watched Dawson's Creek. Yeah. Kevin Williamson, I think, who wrote it, he like made a point of like having them speak in a really like
elevated
manner.
That's fantastic. Yeah, no, but I do remember, I don't know if I saw Dawson's Creek, but I remember there came this point, you know, and I was older where, yes, young people on TV were had phenomenal vocabularies and lots of insight. And I remember just being so happy that was happening.
We finally all caught up to Lisa Kudrow.
That's funny. Yes, finally.
Lisa, we do like to ask people a question that I think most interviews avoid, but we like to ask people about sort of their connection with spirituality. So you mentioned that you had a bat mitzvah. So sort of what was the role that religion played in your life back then, and what's your relationship to spirituality now?
Well, like everything else, I mean, I chose to have a bat mitzvah. I felt like all these friends I have that are Jewish are having bar and bat mitzvahs. I'm Jewish. I need to have a bar mitzvah. I mean, that's who I am. And it wasn't like maybe part social thing. But remember, I didn't have any friends at the time I was deciding to do it. But we had a friend of the family who's a Reformed rabbi, and he got me tapes. And so I just learned from the tapes all the prayers and everything I had to do. And while I couldn't have people at a temple, he let my immediate family into his temple and
let me
bat mitzvahed me. And then I had a party.
Yeah, that's the important
part. And that's where I invited my acquaintances to.
And they came.
Yeah, you know, because other people they knew were going to be there. Yeah, it was going to be fun. Oh, by the way, I'd be there was sort of how it was. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Even though you didn't grow up with like explicitly religious or spiritual relationship to Judaism, or maybe I shouldn't say that, but at least religious.
Culturally, like,
yes. And that's actually what I think is so beautiful about Judaism is its rich kind of, like, for lack of a better word, secular cultural history. You know, it's like, it's not just a religion. It's a lot of things. And so for you at that time, was there like a deepening of your Jewish identity? Was that anything that meant?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, also, I think I'd seen Fiddler on the Roof and understood that's around the area my family was from. And those it just looked so beautiful to me and all those, you know, traditions and stuff. And I actually got myself Shabbat candles. And would on Fridays just in my bedroom like do a little Shabbat.
That's really adorable.
Ceremony. And you know, my family just sort of went, okay. And it didn't last long. But no, I was going through this period where I just wanted to learn. And after that, by the way, I was still fascinated. You know, I took a lot of, when I could, high school and college, Jewish history classes and history of Judaism and comparative Near East studies stuff, because I was really interested.
I mean, I'm aware that in the first season of your show, Who Do You Think You Are, you were exploring your ancestry, right? And you, like, connected to some pretty intense revelations,
Holocaust.
Right?
It was my father's mother's side. And, you know, to be honest, I didn't want to be in the show. I just wanted to produce the show. And then, because I was going after Sarah Jessica Parker, Spike Lee, Susan Sarandon, you know, and I was telling the guy who created the show in the UK, I was like, no, you don't want the likes of me. We want, let's go for like the big names and stuff. And he said, well, it would actually be helpful if you did. I was like, all right. He said, and we know about your, you know, your father's family is from like Mogilev. And I went, what? there's a village name. And I was in, you know, found out something about my, and I also, here's the weird thing. My father told us about the Holocaust and I was too young to hear about it, honestly.
How old?
Well, six. And there was this series called World at War, World War II, and they had like a few episodes or one of just about the Holocaust. And I've sat next to him and watched every one of those. And again, I think I was too young to be seeing that because I would have trouble falling asleep thinking, I thought children were always spared. I thought as a child I'd be safe. And yeah, so it's
scary.
I think I was a little too young for that. And, you know, maybe as a consequence of that, all I knew was, well, I haven't heard that we had any relatives in concentration camps. So the Holocaust, yeah, but maybe not my family. And then I did know my dad had said, my grandmother told me when I was like seven, that her parents were killed by Hitler. And I went, was he like a serial killer? I don't know. What are you talking about? Like, you tell a lot of crazy stories. So I don't know what you're talking about, old lady. And she's like, no. And she'd start crying. He killed Hitler. He killed my mother. He killed my sisters, brothers, and the babies. And I went, okay, I don't know what this could be. But anyway, I just thought, yeah, I'm not sure how affected we are by the Holocaust. So stupid, this weird denial thing. And then sure enough, yeah, because there were death squads that were responsible for about a million Jews being killed throughout, like that Pale of Settlement, you know, and they just round them up and shoot them and bury them in mass graves. So my Who Do You Think You Are was going to the place where my grandmother's family had been killed. And look, a few people escaped and erected a monument. So there's actually a marker for exactly where it happened. And for a lot of places, you know, scattered around Belarus, Ukraine, other areas, there's absolutely no marker at all. So that I just counted that as lucky that I could see that and bear witness, because there's still some people who say it didn't happen.
What was that like to go through that experience, like learn that history on camera, like on a show?
I was worried about that, but I knew the show that I was producing, that they weren't, it's not a gotcha show. So if at any point I felt like I don't want to be on camera anymore, you can shoot me walking away. That's fine. And it also, you know, it helps tell the story that it's that hard that I can't, I don't even know what to say about it. But I remember feeling like, I don't know if I can do another minute of this. It's so hard, actually, reading what happened exactly, talking to a couple people, one guy who was, he was a child when it happened and he watched it. So the weird things in my head were, wow, and in this country, you have to disclose if someone died in a house and you're all still living in this village. And it was like mass murder. And then the other weird thing going through my head was Hitler was Hitler. His like top henchmen who devised his hideous plans are who they are. But every soldier, they were brainwashed, caught up, understood this is what had to be done. And then they had to live with it forever and ever. So there's so many lives ruined.
And we know through like epigenetics that it even like imprints in the DNA of like seven generations. It's like the toll of these things is so unimaginable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've watched a few episodes of your show and I love it. I think like the way that the show treats family history is really like delicate, but not shy. I watched Billy Porter's episode last night, which is really moving.
I think the argument for the way we teach history is made here. It's not about shaming anyone, but it's just reporting, here's what happened. This is how society thought of itself and other people and their place in it. And here's how the people who had to endure that endured. Here's what they had to do to survive.
I think also like, I mean, I imagine that most of us hope that in whatever historical moment we're living, we're like ahead of the curve, but I think for most of us, it's hard to be so far ahead of our like cultural environment. So like the norms of the time, like we're all doing things that maybe future generations will be like, how could they have done?
They will.
They threw things away. They thought you could throw things away.
I mean, just the toll on the planet, you know, all the things we're doing.
And they will. I mean, we're even doing it now looking back at the 70s. Wait, women couldn't get a credit card?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's wild.
What?
Yeah.
You know, and then before that, wait, you know, a woman couldn't get custody of her children. They always went to the father. Oh, they were his children. Okay.
That's totally wild.
Yeah.
And, you know, women couldn't vote. Mm-hmm. There's even some, you know, studies showing like, ooh, maybe we didn't handle COVID exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Some studies.
Trying to be diplomatic.
Yeah. Yes. Well, this is a diplomatic show, so thank you for upholding the banner.
So I read that you and Conan O'Brien and a third person, I'm forgetting his name, had a comedy troupe together for a brief period of time called Unexpected Company. And I was just curious if you could tell us a story or an anecdote from that time.
It was someone else started a sketch comedy group. Then probably someone I knew from the Groundlings who brought me into this. And then I brought Conan into it going, we need to perform. It doesn't matter. Just the experience we've got. And he was like, all right. And we would meet at the Celebrity Center for Scientology.
Wow.
And, yeah, because they were sort of, it was like them doing sort of outreach. You didn't have to be a Scientologist to go in there. And we weren't really bothered when we'd walk in. No one would say, hey, you need to, it didn't happen.
That's nice.
We would rehearse and then perform in the theater space at the Celebrity Center. Scientology, wow. Celebrity Center. And it wasn't great. It wasn't great. It wasn't great, you know, but everyone was nice, decent folk. And, you know, and Conan was just always, that's just, he was, nothing. He had a very high standard, you know, for how things should be.
Did you guys meet in the Groundlings or how? Because that's quite an iconic duo. I also just recently listened to his podcast where he was describing how instrumental you were when he was like getting his iconic late night. I mean, like, right?
You changed the course of history, Lisa.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
So how did you guys meet? I'm just curious because it again.
Yeah, we met because the Groundlings wouldn't allow us to audition for classes because they wouldn't. We hadn't acted. I mean, we didn't do that together, you know. And I went to a class. He wasn't in it, the first class. They sent me to someone else named Cynthia Seghetti, who's a phenomenal improv teacher. They said, why don't you go there first and then you can come audition. So I went to the first class and thought, oh, this isn't for me, I don't think. Because there were a lot of people in there who were actors and they were, you know, making a meal out of stuff and, you know, bad emotional adjustments, you know, sad. Yeah, I mean, that was better than what they were doing. And, you know, and then we'd have to do something. It's like lift a disc. And we all stand around lifting a disc and it's really hard. And they're going, and I'm like, it's not funny. And I don't know what I can't. And I'm hearing her say, commit. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. I've never taken an acting class at all. I was a biology major. I don't know what any of this is. And as I'm talking to them on break, it's like, I have nothing in common with these people. I don't fit. I don't know. I don't think this is going to work out for me. Mm. I don't think I will be an actor. And I was deciding whether or not to go to the second class, honestly, and went, just go. Okay. I was a little late and they were already up on the stage and I didn't want to, you know, interfere. And there was a new guy who's really tall with red hair. And now they're doing space ball, where you act like you're throwing a ball and the different emotional adjustments. And he was just doing it. And he wasn't getting angry. He just looked angry. And she was like, good commitment. I went, that's what commitment means. I can do that. And that's not embarrassing. He's fully going for it. And I am not embarrassed for him. I can do that. I'm going to stick with him. And the minute it was done, I made a beeline for him. Hi, I'm Lisa. And he went, oh, hey, I'm Conan. And we were best friends.
That's so sweet. I like knowing that you guys are friends like that. That's really cute.
Speaking of friends, you were on Mad About You as Ursula first. Uh-huh. And then you were Phoebe on Friends. And I'm just wondering, at what point did they decide that Phoebe and Ursula should be twins. Like, how did that come about? Because it just seems so random, but also really cool.
Well, yeah, it was great. So I was waitress on Mad About You, and she didn't have a name yet. Mm-hmm. And I was about to, like, okay, now I need a day job because I now don't have enough money and acting isn't really working out for me, I think. Mm. And the guy who ran Mad About You, Danny Jacobson, he said, "You're really funny. Is it okay with you if I put you in 5 more episodes and you come back?" And I was like, "Is it okay with me?" Oh my God. Yes, it's the best show. Oh my God, I was so excited. And then, you know, I auditioned for Friends. Because I was available. I was only a recurring role on Mad About You. And I got it both on NBC, and that's why I liked Friends. I also was going to go to the network for a show that was on Fox. And I went, no, definitely the NBC show. Mm. And everyone seems to love it, so that's great. And, you know, the script. And then I can still do Mad About You. Because that was my goal, was protecting Mad About You. Mm. So I'd been already a recurring character on Mad About You. And then they named her Ursula. And I do Friends, and it gets picked up. And after it got picked up, and they also put us on right after Mad About You.
Oh, that's
so funny. I think Mad About You, and I don't know who spoke with who, because they were different studios. Mm. But it was decided that I still get to be a recurring character on Mad About You. And then Friends needs to address the fact that the exact same human being is on a half hour later sometimes. So I think that's how it
happened.
That's amazing. But I don't know what the discussions were with Marta and David and the Mad About You people.
So I like most people, I think, alive, Friends was my favorite show growing up. We watched it as a family. I don't think I've ever watched any show more than I've watched Friends. It's like a comfort show.
Oh,
Phoebe
wow.
was always my favorite character.
Oh,
and at the,
always. Yeah. Yes, I was.
Like, of course, obviously. As it should be.
For what it's worth, it's true for me, too.
Really?
You were my favorite character.
Wow.
Obviously, the writing is incredible. The cast chemistry is incredible. But I feel like the secret ingredient that made Friends different is Phoebe. I feel like there's no character like her on any other show. And I feel like when Friends came out and it was so successful, many people tried to replicate like the ditzy blonde and no one did it. And I've thought about why, because Penn and I have a production company and we look to develop some comedy. So I do think about comedies and I study them. And I really feel like, oh, it's because there's only one Lisa Kudrow. Like, I just don't think anyone else could have pulled off that character. And now meeting you today, I think it's because you're so smart. Like, I think casting someone so smart to play that character is the only way that she could have been both ditzy and have these, like, pockets of brilliance and be so believable.
Oh, thanks.
So I just wanted to give you credit for, I think, being, like, the best female character in the canon of comedy.
Well, wow. Thank you. Oh, my God.
What do you think made Phoebe so special, though?
Yeah, I don't know. And I think I had a good take on her. You know, the audition was this monologue, sort of, that was in the pilot where, she, you know, Rachel's cutting up credit cards and Phoebe, I don't remember it, but it was something around, well, you know, like my mom killed herself and then I was living with this guy in his car and, you know, and then he died, you know, something like that. And I had a friend in college who, you know, had a tough time, you know, like had to leave college and then worked in a nursing home. And her take was always like, and it was like, you're working in a nursing home. Oh, that's so depressing. Yes, well, you know, there's some nice people there. And this one woman, Martha, so funny. And, you know, her play, it's always a mess. And she just had these, like, charm, like, everything was okay.
Mm.
And it was all like, you know, as you do, was sort of her take on everything. Like, as we all know, you know, when you work in a nursing home, you do it this way. And I was like, what? No, I have no idea. So I brought that to Phoebe, just that mindset that was like, you know, as we all know, when your mother kills herself and then as it goes, and the guy you're living with in his car, of course, is, you know, but without that sort of dialect. But yeah, that was the sensibility. I think it's really funny if she thinks like, well, you all know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's like seemingly simple, but makes all the difference.
Yeah. It does, yeah.
We recently had a guest who was a co-star of Penn's on Gossip Girl, and he talked about when that show ended.
Who shall remain nameless.
Chase Crawford. We recently had Chase Crawford on the show. And he talked about the ending of Gossip Girl being like an athlete sort of having an injury and his career just being over from one day to the next, even though his career wasn't over, but it felt like that. It was so jarring. And I'm just wondering what the end of Friends was like for you and your like sense of self and identity.
Mm. Oh, well, I mean, I think we all just in a very healthy way just mourned the goodbye to these people. You know, I mean, I don't know if you know, but every year we weren't sure if we were going to be coming back.
Really?
Well, because of the cast deciding whether or not we wanted to come back, because people were getting like different opportunities and stuff. And, you know, so I know there was more than one season before that where I actually, the last day of, you know, season 8 or 7, whatever it was, I was driving home and I burst into tears because I was really going to miss Phoebe.
Oh, wow.
I was just going to miss being her, inhabiting her. I was going to just miss her and cried. So, yeah. And then when we knew we were going to be done, it was, okay, we are definitely going to be done. And it's, you know, coping. Mm-hmm. But we cried. Oof. We cried that night. It was a lot of boo-hooing, you know. But then it was also, okay, and so it's time to move on because we have to move on. And so it's right. Whatever's happening, okay, so this is right. There's no choice. Make it okay.
I'm thinking about the Friends reunion that happened during the pandemic. That was huge, like a huge production. I've never seen anything like that for any other show. I loved it. But I did wonder what it felt like for you all as a cast. Like, does it feel good and nostalgic to go back to that place? Or does it feel like, okay, it's over?
It felt great and nostalgic to go back to that place. I mean, the six of us had only ever been in a room together after the show, you know, like 5 years before that for one dinner at Jennifer's house.
Wow.
And that was heaven. I mean, it was as if no time had passed, and that was great. And so we were really looking forward to that. And it's neat that the sets were there and all of that. To me, I didn't care about the sets. I cared about seeing the
people. Of
course,
yeah.
That's what was exciting to me.
Yeah.
It was just, it was great, and it was so well done. You know, the other thing that we all had people coming up to us here and there over the many years, you know, who would say, oh, that it was really important to me during a hard time in my life. And thank you. And all of that. It's like, oh, that's nice. You know, here and there, I guess there's a person, you know, that it was beneficial to. But when we sat down and he showed us all like from around the world, these different testimonials, and there were a few more than what made it into the, you know, the final cut. We were a wreck. We were sobbing. We were so moved. And, you know, and it's not just true for Friends. That's what entertainment does.
That's true. Yeah.
I used to feel like, well, all right. I mean, we're just, you know, entertainers.
We're not curing cancer over here.
We're not curing cancer, but we are.
Yeah.
And it's an important escape.
Headline, Lisa Kudrow thinks entertainers are curing cancer.
I mean, no, just
us,
no one is curing cancer.
You just got us a bunch of listeners, so thank you so much.
I didn't say that. But it is. It's a great mental health break, you know?
No, you're absolutely right.
And then, I'm sorry. I'm going to tell you something else. You can cut it.
No, tell us everything.
You know, now I'm just wasting your time because you've got to direct your show.
But, somebody's got to.
But so after 9/11... You know, everyone was, it was shut down for 2 weeks, and you're just watching CNN or you're just watching news all day long. And it's all about, you know, what happened on 9/11. And I remember I was watching Will and Grace was on. I went, oh, okay. And automatically thought, oh, this takes place in New York. Oh God, I wonder if they knew anyone in the towers. And then went, no, that's, you know, this was shot before 9/11. It didn't happen yet in this episode. And then I realized, no.
It's not going to.
It's not going to. This is a world where that didn't happen. And it was such a relief. And then when we were, you know, back to work and I would drive home, I used to drive home and people would pull up next to me at a light and go, ah, hey. And now people would pull up next to me and look over and just go, about to cry. And I knew exactly what they were talking about because I experienced the same thing, you know, watching Will and Grace. And then it struck me like, it's not unimportant entertainment.
No.
People need a break.
Yeah.
They do need a break.
Especially something as feel good as friends.
Yeah. You know, but before we go, I do, this is a bit of a non sequitur. Maybe we can take it out or place it at the end. I don't want the interview to pass without saying that your performance in The Comeback is genuinely, I think, one of the best performances I've seen. Aww, it came out, I think, at a moment that I was particularly receptive to it. And it just, yeah, I thought you were like kind of breathtaking, you know, poignant.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
there's that.
That means a lot. Thank you. I think I'm the most proud of that than anything.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it really is incredible.
I mean, that show. Beautiful.
Lisa, we have one question that we ask everybody at the end of the interview.
Okay.
If you could go back to 12-year-old Lisa and say one thing, have a moment with her, what would you want to say?
Oh, dear. The people are mean because of what they're going through. Don't take it in. It's nothing to do with you. You're still allowed to like yourself. You really are.
Well, thank you so much. It's so wonderful to have you, Lisa.
Yes, it was so
It was not a disappointment. At the beginning, you said it would be, and it was the opposite.
No, but I was so heavy.
Oh, that's great.
We love heavy. Up next, Penn reads today's listener-submitted middle school story. Stick around.
I grew up in a small town about an hour south of Philadelphia called Emmaus. Emmaus. Note to listener, I don't know how to pronounce this. Anyway, moving on. In 2015, when I was in eighth grade, I was assigned a new lab partner in science, a troubled skater boy named Oz. To be honest, Oz completely scared me, but I knew he had troubles at home and probably just needed a few friends. At the time, I also needed some friends. A few weeks after studying together as lab partners, Oz was waiting for me outside my house, except I never told him where I lived. When I asked why he was waiting for me, he just asked if we could hang out. I was completely terrified of boys, especially of Oz. I cried out, "No, you have to go home." The next day at school, I asked him how he knew where I lived. "I saw your address on a letter you sent," he replied, which really scared me. I did want boys to like me, but not boys that scared me. So a week passes, and one day I walked home from school from my bus stop like usual. I ate, then immediately I took a nap, and my mom wakes me up. "Honey," she said, "someone is at the door for you." It was Oz. By then I had a sick feeling and was legitimately scared. I told him he needed to leave. That did not make him happy. He literally ripped out a chunk of the sidewalk and threw it on the ground, smashing it into a million pieces, and walked away. I was horrified. That week, in science class, it was my turn to present a PowerPoint slide all about the water cycle. So I got up and began presenting. When I clicked to go to the second slide, all of my work had been deleted. In its place was a message for me. "I can't wait to see your face when you read this, dumb bitch." I stood there, humiliated, in front of my entire class. After some investigating, the school confirmed that Oz had hacked into my project and hijacked it with his message. Where is Oz now? Jail. For pistol whipping someone. I guess the lesson here is trust your intuition. You can catch Lisa in her animated series Housebroken, and new episodes of Who Do You Think You are available on Hulu and Peacock. You can also just follow her online at Lisa Kudrow.
Podcrushed is hosted by Penn Badgley, Nava Kavalin, and Sophie Ansari.
Our executive producer is Nora Ritchie from Stitcher.
Our lead producer and editor is David Ansari.
Our secondary editor is Sharaf Entwistle.
Special thanks to Peter Clowney, VP of Content at Stitcher, Eric Eddings, Director of Lifestyle Programming at Stitcher, Jared O'Connell and Brendan Brines for the tech support, and Shruti Marate, who transcribes our tape.
Podcrush was created by Nava Kavalin and is executive produced by Penn Badgley and Nava Kavalin and produced by Sophie Ansari. This podcast is a Ninth Mode production. Be sure to subscribe to Podcrush. You can find us on Stitcher, the SiriusXM app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. If you'd like to submit a middle school story, go to podcrush.com and give us every detail.
And while you're online, be sure to follow us on socials. It's at Podcrush, spelled how it sounds, and our personals are at Penn Badgley, at Nava, that's Nava with three N's, and at Scribble by Sophie. And we're out. See you next week.
doing too many things at once.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's really...
Well, you know, gotta make hay, as they say.
You do. Yeah. You gotta make hay?
When the sun's shining. What? Is that the expression? Make hay, you gotta make hay when the sun shines or something.
Stitcher.